it's not just me who thought Bernie would win the general election. Donald Trump's own pollster showed up at Harvard for the post-election review, and when asked what would have happened if Sanders was the nominee, he said he would have won.
Welcome to the Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. In 2016, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders was an insurgent presidential candidate taking on Hillary Clinton, the heavily favored pick of the Democratic establishment. As Sanders barnstormed the country and brought his message to millions of people, the Clinton machine's operatives and super PACs swung into action to stop him by any means necessary. Tad Devine was deep in the trenches of this fight. He's a veteran Democratic political operative and was chief strategist for Sanders' 2016 presidential campaign. Prior to that, Devine had been a senior advisor in the presidential campaigns of Al Gore in 2000 and John Kerry in 2004. Tad Devine has come out with an explosive new book about the 2016 Democratic primary titled How the Democrats Screwed Bernie. His inside account comes as a new generation of populist Democrats, including New York City Mayor Zohran Mamdani and Maine Senate candidate Graham Platner, is once again challenging the Democratic establishment and receiving fierce pushback from the old guard. Devine argues that the entrenched leadership of the Democratic Party seems determined to forget the mistakes it made during the primary season of 2016. He blames the Democratic elite for two catastrophic defeats in the recent past and who knows how many more to come in the future. Tad Devine spoke to me from his home in Rhode Island. Tad Devine, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
David, great to be with you.
So the obvious question here is, why are you writing a postmortem of the 2016 Democratic primary for president a decade later?
Well, I had no intention of doing it, to tell you the truth. And it just so happened. And I write about this in the acknowledgments because I thought people might be curious as to that question. I decided to lay it out there. You know, I got an email and I happened to be at a friend's house in Manhattan, believe it or not, which is a place I don't frequent. But my friend, you know, lives there part of the year, and it was his birthday party. So an old friend who I went to high school with. And well, you know, I get this email from Ian Strauss, who said he was an editor at Simon & Schuster. And I thought to myself, gee, the scammers are really getting imaginative these days. They send you an email, say you're going to write a book for a big publisher, and they suck you in. And so, you know, when I was looking at it, I didn't see any links in it. So I said, well, I'll just check this guy out. So I said, yeah, I'd be very interested in talking to you. And next thing you know, he's back to me. We had breakfast the next morning. One thing leads to another. I'm doing a Zoom with the editor-in-chief at Simon & Schuster. And then, you know, my daughter and her husband is actually writing a book right now, which is based on his dissertation. You know, it's called NIMBY Nation. It's going to be published next year about housing policy. And they said, you know, you should get an agent because another friend of mine who had been involved in publishing as a college president said, they don't want to talk to you. They want to talk to your agent. So I was like, so I got an agent. I didn't really know what I was doing. And she negotiated a deal with us. The publisher wanted me to write a book with another person, preferably a political reporter who worked on the race, you know. And I said, I was very reluctant. I said, listen, I don't feel I can write a book with anybody. I just have to express myself, and I certainly can't negotiate with what's going to go on into something that has my name on it. But as the agent later explained to me when I was talking to her, the timeline, which was, this was now the end of May, and the deadline was December 15th, that for me to turn in a full book in that time period, that I really should get some help. So I wound up, you know, hiring Marianne Sedjadomadzic, who is a journalist and a writer herself, a very accomplished writer, and has worked on a number of projects with other people writing books. And she really did help me to organize this, to put it together. We hired a fact checker as well, you know, so I had a lot of help so I could fit that deadline of December 15th. And we began a process, Marianne and Ian, who turned out to be a real person and is a great guy, you know, Ian Strauss at Simon & Schuster. We started this process in June, and they basically assigned me a task of writing 10 chapters of it. And I took the summer of 2025 doing that. And at the day after Labor Day, I sent them 50,000 words. And I think they were, you know, maybe expecting 10 or 10,000 words or an outline of something that could become a book. But I really threw myself into it. And, you know,
Let me just interrupt, Ted. I want to get to the why. Again, we're talking about a Democratic primary, not the general election, a decade later. Why did this seem important?
You know, David, and I'm sorry to be so long-winded in my answer, but I didn't really come to that answer until I finished that summer of writing this. And when I started out, it was more like, okay, I'll write a book, and how hard can that be? But then I found out by doing it. And then what I found out was that this story of what happened in 2016 had, in my view, had tremendous relevance to what's going on today. It's a story about a political party that doesn't want to listen to voters. Okay, that's what the story is about. That we have to begin to trust voters, that we have to empower voters and let them make the decisions about the outcome. Because I believe in 2016, we did not have that process. We had a process where the Democratic National Committee was controlled by the Clinton campaign. And, you know, you can't have the party mechanism being controlled by one campaign and say that the process is fair. It is fundamentally unfair where that happens. And there were a lot of other things that were rigging it as well. And I wanted to speak to all of them. And I wanted it to be a lesson to our party today, because the next presidential election may be one of the most consequential in the history, the 250-year history of this nation. And we have to recognize that. And I thought this story would have relevance. And the more I got into it, the more I understood why I was writing it and what I wanted to say about it.
So we're going to circle back to those other issues. I do want to, I can't help but ask, you were a Democratic Party insider. You were seemingly the antithesis of Bernie Sanders. Explain your mutual attraction to one another and what it dates back to, because, of course, it predates the 2016 presidential campaign.
Well, it's true. We were, I mean, Bernie once said to me, I think I put this in the book, that, you know, Tad, you're my link to the establishment. And this was later, after I had worked for him in his House race in 1996, in his Senate race in 2006. And now, you know, post-Senate race, but pre-presidential race. And I said to him, you know, I said, Bernie, you're a United States Senator. That is the establishment. Okay, what are you talking about? But it was true. I mean, I had a lot of sort of access. I remember one time walking with him when he was going to the House. We were talking in his office. He says, I've got a vote. Walk with me. I want to talk to you some more. So we walk over, we go through the Atlanta, we come out. He's about to walk on into the floor of the House to cast a vote. And Steny Hoyer, who was still, you know, a leader way back when, walked by. And Steny comes by and says, hey, Tad, how are you? Good to see you. It is. He's like, blows off Bernie, you know? And I'm like, okay, I see what he means now when he's talking about this, you know? But, you know.
He was considered a crank. People were. Yeah. Did
well,
not take him seriously.
A lot of people did not take him seriously. I agree with that. And what, you know, and I think what attracted me to Bernie was his authenticity, his honesty, his commitment to issues, you know, particularly core economic issues, which I believe before I met him, and I still believe today after, you know, having worked for him a few times, is really the key to success in elections. That if we convince people that we will be on their side in the fights that lie ahead, the real core fights, what are their wages like? Can they buy a house? Do they have an opportunity to have health care that takes care of themselves and their families? These are the concerns now, more than ever, of ordinary Americans. And I think, you know, his fight to make that the priorities of the Democratic Party, I think, is a fight that he's trying to win. And if the Democratic Party as an institution wins it, we will win elections.
So take us back to before 2016, when you're deciding whether to work for Bernie and Bernie's deciding what a presidential race would look like. How far a long shot was he at the beginning of the process?
He was the longest of long shots. And the reason he was the system. You know, and I, you know, talked to Bernie about that. And he and Jane asked me to go to their home in Burlington in April of 2016. And we spent the weekend, pretty much the three of us together, just, you know, arguing and going back and forth about whether you're going to do this. And by the time we got to Sunday afternoon of that, you know, weekend meeting, you know, I was really pushing him. And since I had all of this background, I mean, I worked for Jimmy Carter, Walter Mondale, and Mike Dukakis, all of them, you know, as a delegate tracker as a kid, as the deputy director, as, you know, a graduate of law school and beginning of my career, and then as the director of it for Dukakis. So I had this enormous decade of expertise within the system of the Democratic Party. And then later worked for other, you know, candidates for president, Gore and Kerry included, you know, seeing it from that level as well. And I laid it out to him how the way the system was structured with almost 800 superdelegates, of which he would have only a handful in the end, you know, of proportional representation, you know, of all of these other aspects of the system, the primary system, the way it worked, et cetera, that his likelihood of success was almost zero. And I challenged him and I said, listen, there's only one way for you to win. You have to win Iowa, you have to win New Hampshire, you have to win Nevada, and then we have to figure out how to win South Carolina, which is going to be very tricky. And after you do that, we're going to take us on a second front from the entire establishment, okay, who, you know, won't even come to your events, okay? Trust me, and basically do what they did to Mandami, you know, in the mayor's race in New York. And I said, you know, why? Tell me why you're going to do this, because I'm telling you, as someone who has spent a big chunk of his career doing this, you cannot win in this system. Tell me why you're doing it. And he did
right.
tell me
you're,
why. Was,
you're explaining to him that it is, it, but, yeah. you're explaining to him that it's structurally impossible because this yes. system of superdelegates yes. who are chosen by the party elders, by the establishment, is structurally going to block you as That's well right. as you may do in out in the field. So how did you convince yourself that you could surmount that structural blockade?
Well, at first, I didn't convince myself because when he told me that he didn't want to be a backbencher, okay, I'll leave out the colorful parts of that, you know, I understood his motivation. I really wanted to understand his motivation in order for me to do this with him because if I didn't understand it, I don't know how we could succeed. And when he told me that, he wanted to bring this message out to every state in the country for people to hear it. I understood the value of it too. So, you know, so once we got to that point, you know, I understood the motivation. Then as we got into it, okay, and we started to go from way behind in the polls, way behind in the fundraising to beginning to catch up in the polls in the early states, Iowa, New Hampshire, first of all, where we were communicating with voters, even after we gave the Clinton campaign a 3-month head start in communicating, because they went on in August, we didn't go on TV until November, in part because they had such a financial lead, and also in large part because Bernie at that juncture was like refusing to do any polling, and I was refusing to make any ads until we did polling, okay? So we had to overcome that impasse before we could get to the point where we really had a shot. But once I saw that we could win, you know, beginning in Iowa, where technically she may have prevailed, and they, you know, that night, the election night in Iowa, they were putting out press releases that it made it sound like, you know, a landslide in the general election that they had just won by 0.3% with 5 coin tosses that we lost in various caucus plans. It was ridiculous, you know. But then to see it in New Hampshire, to see an open primary, and that was the 100th year history of the New Hampshire open primary in 2016. And Bernie Sanders, 150,000 votes. No one had ever got near that number. John McCain, when he got 110,000 in 2000, I thought, as someone who spent a lot of time going to New Hampshire primaries for many years, no one would ever beat that. But Bernie did. So we saw that. And listen, we were 25 points behind in Nevada, according to the Clinton campaign polling. Okay, forget our polling. You know, we were behind in our polling, too. And we almost pulled that off. And if Harry Reid, I think, hadn't decided to go south on us in the last minute, at least according to John Ralston, who's the the best observer of Nevada politics for many, many years, someone who's on the ground there, understands what happened and spelled it out in USA Today in an op-ed a week after the caucuses, I think we would have won in Nevada. So, you know, so we really did. When we went from nowhere to the thing I outlined when I talked to him back in April of 2015, when Iowa, when New Hampshire, when Nevada, well, technically we didn't do that, but we practically did. We were so close to winning those three that we may have made it, you know, been able to make a run. I mean, it was tougher in South Carolina. Everyone focuses on race there because it's such a huge African-American vote. But one of our biggest problems in South Carolina winning was that the Republican primary and the Democratic Party primary that year were on two separate days. So, and if the Republican primary had been 3 weeks after ours, I think we would have had a legitimate shot of winning it. Because what happened was a lot of people, went and voted in the Republican primary, which made them ineligible to vote in the Democratic primary 3 weeks later in South Carolina. And, you know, if, you know, and a lot of them went and voted for Trump.
But I just want to, I mean, you're recounting primaries that Bernie lost.
Yes.
Damn close, closer than anyone thought. But these were losses. What is giving you optimism from losses? I mean, I get it. He's doing better. He's exceeding expectations. But, you know, to win, you got to win. And he wasn't winning at that point. So what made you think this could go well?
Well, I thought it could go well because it was a campaign that was growing organically everywhere. Okay, it was the people were coming out on their own. Number one, number two, I thought we could do well because I saw what he was doing in terms of attracting people. If you look at the summer of 2018, you will see Bernie Sanders taking trips to places like Minneapolis and, you know, getting 10,000 people at the West Coast, 25,000 in Portland, 27,500 in Los Angeles, you know, Seattle, huge crowds of people. He actually, by the time the primary was over, he had managed to give his, you know, he calls them meetings, you know, we call them rallies, to give his stump speech before 1 million people in person. I mean, it's a lot of people. You know, and that helped us to organize the campaign. So that gave me a lot of confidence. Meanwhile, Hillary Clinton was not running that kind of campaign. She would occasionally do a photo op or show up for a discussion on foreign policy or some other issue and things like that. We were out building at the grassroots because that was always the politics he practiced in Vermont. You know, there was always going to be an organizational side to this campaign. It was, yeah, I focused on the television ads because that was my responsibility and my partners and I did that together. But we, you know, built a campaign from the ground up the way he had built local campaigns beginning in Iowa and New Hampshire. And I believed that we could do that. And we did do it in a lot of places. And that yielded victory in some very important states like Wisconsin and Michigan, for example.
Can you do remind us again, it's been a decade. Where did Bernie win in 2016?
Well, I wish I could recount all of the 23 primaries and caucuses that he won by. I'll go to, through it in my head. You know, I mean, in New Hampshire,
the biggest, the most important ones.
Well, I would say, you know, Wisconsin and Michigan were probably the biggest because just think, you know, in the general election, the ramifications of being able to win those states, that it's the difference between victory and defeat, you know. And I would argue that we didn't win Pennsylvania in the primary because it was a closed Democratic primary. If it had been an open primary, we would have won there, too.
Now, that's, and explain the difference between closed and open.
Well, closed primaries are ones that only allow Republicans to vote in the Republican primary, people registered as Republicans, and Democrats to vote in the Democratic primary. Open primaries, like we have here in my state of Rhode Island, which is a very Democratic state, by the way, independents, who are a very large block of voters. In Rhode Island, there are a few more Democrats, there's a lot of independents, and there aren't many Republicans. I think Vermont is probably similarly situated, you know, and, you know, Bernie won that open primary that day. All the other primaries that same day were close, and he lost them. It's because those independents came flooding into the Democratic side and overwhelmingly supported Bernie, and that provided his margin of victory. To me, it's a harbinger of what would have happened in the general election. And, you know, and by the way, it's not just me who thought Bernie would win the general election. Bernie, Donald Trump's own pollster showed up at Harvard for the post-election review, and when asked what would have happened if Sanders was the nominee, he said he would have won. Okay, because he's number one, an honest guy, you know, and number two, he understood that those white working class voters who fled Hillary Clinton would have gone back to Bernie Sanders, who they already voted for in the primaries in places like Wisconsin and Michigan.
So what does it look like from the inside of the Bernie Sanders 2016 campaign to hit the Clinton juggernaut when Clinton pulls out all the stops, all the levers of power and money that she and her husband, President Bill Clinton, have cultivated and built to that point? What does that look like from your end? You're essentially, it feels like you're describing rowing a dinghy into the side of, you know, a super tanker.
Yes. It reminds me of that quote, that politics ain't beanbag, okay? Well, which, you know, that's what it's like. Basically, what happens is when you go into it and you're in there with that fight, you're going to get a lot of blowback. Now, of course, most of that blowback is directed at the candidate, you know, and that meant that, you know, I mean, if you watch Bill Clinton, for example, who, by the way, I respect and I've certainly seen him, you know, I was Bob Kerry's campaign manager in 1992, and I saw what Bill Clinton did in the New Hampshire primary to get himself into second place and to ultimately win the nomination. He's an incredible campaigner. But he spent the week before the New Hampshire primary in 2016 lambasting Bernie Sanders, really going after him hard, you know, on a lot of stuff that I thought was absolutely out of bounds, you know, and, you know, essentially saying he was against Obama because, you know, Bernie was advocating for Medicare for all and not Obamacare. You know what I mean? You know, and a lot of other sort of inside things about, you know, him and his campaign. So you get hit at a very high level. Surrogates who came out, the Black Caucus did a press conference for the South Carolina primary. I write about some of this stuff in my book. I don't think it was fair at all, you know. Some people who I respect and admire, and you know, I've thought of myself as maybe being crazy. They're saying John Lewis did something very bad, but he did when he, you know, when he said he did, I never knew Bernie Sanders, you know, in the civil rights struggle. Well, you know, I mean, that's understandable if you were in Atlanta and he was in Chicago, but you know, but it was it, there was a, you know, the full orchestrated effort of the party, and then the super PACs. The dark money, bringing in all of this stuff. Hillary had said, "Oh, I'm just raising this money with the party to have for the general election if I succeed." The truth is, a lot of that money came in. They started communicating with voters. They were offsetting expenses that they otherwise would have paid for in the campaign by using the money that had been part of, you know, what they said was going to be general election funds. So and also there's the press. You know, a lot of people in the press who are very interested in having access to the president and being told by all the experts that she is inevitable in terms of her nomination, you know, wind up getting that access if they write the right kind of stories. And I'll give you a personal example. I didn't write about this in the book, but I'm not afraid to talk about it in public. You know, after New York, one of my business partners got a call from a friend who I knew as well, who had just got off a phone call with the Clinton campaign. And he said the purpose of the phone call was that they were going to organize a campaign against me personally, Tad Devine, in the press, because the only reason Bernie was staying in the campaign was so Tad could stick money in his pocket. And within days, you know, publications like the Washington Post put out stories about Bernie Sanders is spending millions going to the consultants for the TV buy, and it was a big hit piece on me. And you know, so you basically get into the, you know, you become a target, you're in the crosshairs, get ready, okay? Because you know, a lot of that firepower is going to be thrown against the candidate, and a lot of firepower will be thrown against the people either supporting that candidate or, you know, voting for them. Nina Turner, I you know, who Bernie wanted to sit here to second him at the election, they would not allow her on the podium. Because, you know, she hadn't been loyal enough to Hillary, you know, at that point in time. So I think that's what comes with it. You basically, and I describe it from sort of the consultant perspective, which is, you know, you're on you're in the out list. You're not going to get, you know, no one at any of the committees is going to allow you to work for someone who's running for Congress, the House or the Senate, because of your association with people who, you know, have criticized the party. You know,
So
that's what happened.
let's talk about, so these are, I mean, these things do sound like the very predictable things that a powerful establishment insider will do. What about the mistakes that you and Bernie's campaign made in 2016? What could he have done differently that might have resulted in beating Hillary Clinton?
Well, listen, I advocated from the beginning to run more of a, you know, modern, research-driven campaign. Now, I think for Bernie, I mean, at the beginning, he was like, I mean, he was very sincere in his beliefs. You know, at one point, he said to me, "Listen, Tad, go with your gut. That's what I do." And you know, and I told him, I said, "Listen, that's part of the reason I admire you, but my job is different than yours. I am not going to make television ads when I don't know who the targets are. I am not going to spend lots of money that you're raising, buying expensive television ads and communicating them to people who we don't have a chance of winning. Okay, I'm just not going to do it because I was trained as a lawyer, and to me, it's malpractice. You know, so I think if he had said, "Listen, okay, you know, let's do polling, let's do research, let's understand the electorate beginning in Iowa and New Hampshire, let's understand." our vulnerabilities and our opponent's vulnerabilities. Okay, and let's do that through research. Okay, that's what I was advocating. And we did not do that. I mean, we did, man, Jeff Weaver and I think we were off the reservation on this one, managed to sneak a couple of questions into one poll that went to Iowa and New Hampshire about two negative questions on Bernie, two negative questions on Hillary. Now, normally we'd be doing polls on this, you know, we'd be doing focus groups where we would sit, we would show ads to people beforehand. We would gauge their reaction to attacks and the back and forth that it would play itself out in campaign. We did none of that in his campaign because he simply did not want that kind of campaign. You know, in many ways, Bernie believe I think felt, gee, if we do polling, people are going to say, oh, he's just doing these polls. When in fact, what we did, we finally did polling. And when we did the polling, what we found out was what he was talking about, which is this notion that the economy is rigged and the rigged economy is held in place by a corrupt system of campaign finance, the issues that he advocated, including Medicare for all, but also a living wage, you know, a huge infrastructure rebuilding program, climate change concerns, but also climate change rooted in building an economy at home. You know, you don't, you know, offshore people who install solar panels to houses in America, okay? Those jobs are going to be right here, you know? So all of the things that he was talking about resonated powerfully. So he did, and some of the things that we tested in our polling, I'll give you a perfect example. You know, Bernie was supporting a $15 an hour minimum wage. We tested that in Iowa. It did not do very well. That was, Hillary Clinton was opposed to that 15-hour minimum wage after Iowa. Now, later, You know, we showed Bernie the results. He wasn't going to ever change his, you know, commitment to a principle like that, no matter what the polling said. He wasn't really concerned with, you know, the polling numbers. He was much more concerned with people. And I think he did his own polling, which he would stand in front of them for an hour and 15 minutes. He would give these long, substance-driven speeches, and he would see how they reacted to him. And on the basis of that, I think he developed a really good gut instinct on where people were in that election. Here's a guy who put himself in front of 1 million people in the course of that primary. And that's better, really, than, you know, 150 polls. It really is. It gives you an enormous sense of where people are.
So in 2020, Bernie Sanders runs again for president.
Right.
And you acquit. You sign off. You began that being on his team and then left. Why?
Right. Well, I think by the end, and I write about this in the book. At the, you know, by the time we got to California, we were definitely on different planets. You know, I think he viewed me as, you know, really not in touch with what he was doing and what he wanted to do. A lot of the end of campaign stories came out, and they tend to be, if you lose, you get killed. You know, that's the way it goes. But I think Bernie's interpretation of it was that they were making me look and they look good, and they were making him look bad, and he was really not pleased with that result. And you know, and I basically, you know, after we had a meeting with him and he and Jane in their living room in the home in Burlington, the night after the California primary, we flew back to Burlington, and then late that next night we had the meeting in there, and I advocated a course of action which nobody was with. I was like the only one in the room. I mean, my course of action was, listen, go in the other room, call up Hillary Clinton, tell her you're going to support her in any way. She needs the summer. You just got to give him some room. She's going to have a hard time beating Trump. You know, I kind of made my pitch about it's time to surrender, you know, to talk to Hillary, you know. And his view was, no, we have to negotiate because the platform of the party, we need to do these things, and these people will be with me. They're going to take some time to come over, and I can't just. And I was like, well, the platform doesn't mean anything to me. I'm sorry. I don't think it's impactful. This is not a parliamentary system. I've worked a lot in governments that are elected in Ireland, for example, where I worked for 23 years for Fianna Fáil. And, you know, when you elect a government in a parliamentary system, the same people who are the members of the legislature are the cabinet, okay? And so, guess what? They're going to do whatever they want to do when they have that kind of control. We don't have that system here in America. We have, you know, a government, you know, that's divided by our constitution. And, you know, so I was like, really, she just needs this time. And when I realized, you know, I'm giving advice for a living and I'm not being listened to, why bother? You know, I sort of left at that time. He reached out to me to help with the speech for when he was endorsing Hillary. The campaign reached out to me to sort of redo the America ad and to use it as his introduction at the convention. But I had left by then. And by the time we got to 2010, two of my business partners were still with Bernie, and we got to the next campaign, and they were going to be with Bernie. I was like, listen, that's fine. I'm just, you know, I'm sort of done, okay? I'm, you know, good luck, you know, do your best. But at the beginning of that campaign, I think they felt, there was going to be an announcement video, and I saw the announcement video, and we all came to work Monday morning, and I said to him, did you guys do that? Because I don't think that was, and they said, well, no, we did one, but he didn't really like ours. So they've done another one. And I said, well, listen, guys, I've been very supportive of you working for Bernie, but our name is on this stuff. And when it goes out in the press that we're doing this stuff, I don't want to be associated with it. Okay. And they were like, well, you know what? Neither do we. And so that's when we all left. Okay. When we sort of got to that breakpoint in 2020.
So let me ask, let's fast forward to today. Donald yeah. Trump has historically low poll numbers, hovering close to 30% approval. And the only entity close to him in disapproval is the Democratic Party.
Yes.
Why? Yeah. Why do people hate the Democratic Party, especially at this moment?
Well, that gets back to your first question, is why'd you write this book? Okay. And that is an additional reason. I think the Democratic Party is down with, the levels of Trump right now, because it's completely out of touch with the American people. Okay, period. I think that it needs to demonstrate that it understands their concerns and priorities, that it will be on their sides in the fights that lie ahead, that it shares the values. And I think right now we're not doing that because, there are a lot of reasons. Because one is because we still participate in a system which is ultimately a rigged system, okay? A system of campaign finance, which allows powerful special interests to buy their way, into policies that promote them in the government, okay? And we have to, I think, break from that stranglehold of money in politics and establish ourselves as a party that is willing to, seek funding through people at the grassroots level that will work tirelessly to overturn the Supreme Court's opinion, not only in Citizens United, but in a series of cases, which I write about in the book, that support this rigged system, and to return the United States to a level playing field where we don't gerrymander the congressional seats, where we don't pour massive amounts of money, not just at the presidential level, but even now at the local level. The dark money that is moving into politics and buying elections has to be stopped if we're going to take back our government. I mentioned before I worked a lot in other campaigns. I think I've done 29 campaigns outside the United States in my career, all around the world. And in Western Europe, if people did what we do legally here in the United States, if they threw money into campaigns anonymously, they would go to jail. Okay.
Yes. So listen, I am, and as I think many listeners are, and I am, I agree with you how deeply corrupt the American system of campaigning. It is a system of open bribery, right, where you can plow money into candidates, and maybe not open. There's a thin curtain protecting the identities if you, support super PACs and all these things that people don't even understand. How do you unrig a system that has evolved in this fashion, that is protected by Supreme Court, decisions and such? We can all agree it's rigged, but it is the system that we are left running, campaigns in now. What do you do about it?
Well, there's two words to lay out a roadmap to fix the system. One is elections and, winning them. And the second is the Constitution and overriding the Supreme Court. Okay. That is the only way home right now for America. Okay. I remember when McGovern gave Come Home America's speech. Okay. It may be a low point for the Democratic Party, but the message is true today. The citizens of this nation need to take control of their destiny and their future. We cannot, I have two grandsons now. I've got another granddaughter on the way. Okay. We're all getting to a point in time where we have to think about the future and our responsibilities to our children and grandchildren. Our biggest responsibility today is to take back the system of our own government. Okay. And the only way to do that is by winning elections, beginning with the midterms in 2026, the presidency in 2028, state and local elections at all levels as well. And then we must amend the Constitution of the United States so it prohibits the practices of campaign finance that are in place today. I don't think that's a pipe dream. A lot of people come to this pipe. It's the cynicism that exists in America and in American politics that is leading people to that conclusion. The facts are very clear. Overwhelming majorities of Democrats, Republicans, and Independents support changing the system of campaign finance. They lack today the leadership to make it happen. It's waiting for a visionary leader or leaders to come out and to move the nation in that direction. And it's much harder to convince 80% of the people to support an issue than it is to get an issue passed in a Democratic government where 80% of the people are already there. Okay, that the hard part is convincing them. They're there. They just need a mechanism to express this. And when that happens, I think politics will change in America and will give it back its soul.
Does that leader have a name and a face in your?
Well, I'm not, really involved in anybody's campaign, but I trust and believe that if we have a fair process for president next time, such a leader can emerge.
When you survey the landscape out there, and you're a guy who sees further down the road, that's you're in that business. Do you see anyone who has promise?
Yeah, I think a lot of people have promise. But remember, Obama was a state senator in Illinois at this juncture of the campaign calendar, okay, before he was elected in 2006, okay? I mean, he was a state senator before the midterm elections, okay, and he went on to succeed in the presidency. So maybe there's a state elected official in Texas who becomes like that, okay? If he accede to higher office. Maybe there's someone who's running for governor yet to be elected who would actually fill that role, even though they haven't made it there yet. And then there are a lot of people, I think, on the horizon. Governor Moore in Maryland, I think, is a very impressive figure. The governor of Pennsylvania, the governor of California. I know he's out there leading on a lot of stuff, but I think he's also demonstrated a great capacity to deal with this environment. And, governors, I think there are members of the Senate. I think there are members of the House of Representatives. You don't have to be a longtime senator to be the nominee of the party anymore. People can come up very quickly in this day of instant communication. So I don't have anybody I'm supporting for president. I'm working in my own state on three elections here for governor, for attorney general, and for my representative in Congress. And that's how I'm keeping busy.
Let me get you to drive up I-95 an hour or two and weigh in on what would your advice be to Graham Plattner, a Bernie protege, yeah. Who's waging very much the kind of campaign that you were trying to wage in the two, in your work with Bernie?
Well, I saw the New York Times poll that just came out along with the Portland Press Herald,
it's essentially a dead heat.
It's a dead heat. He's 2 points ahead, but it's a dead heat. My advice to him would be that, and I write about this in the book at some length, that the key to succeeding with voters are three elements. One is authenticity. I don't think he's ever going to lose an authenticity war to Susan Collins. I will tell you that right now. Number two, it's emotion and trying to develop, particularly in the advertising and also, the events that you hold, is to make an emotional connection to the heart, to the soul of people, not just with the issues you run on, but the things, the way that you talk about these things in very human terms. And then the third element of it is storytelling. You have to tell a story to people that they remember. So trying to put these stories together, whether it revolves around the people you met on the campaign trail or, your own life and experience. I think if you do that and you confront the issues that come at you. I write about this in the book. It's the day after Bernie announced suddenly a flood of all these things he wrote in 1972 or in front of people in alternative publications. And, the way you deal with that, and, later it was his, the legitimacy of his son's birth, which Bernie seemed to be troubled about. I was far less troubled about, the answer is when it comes at you, because it inevitably it will, and it's come at him a lot, and there's more to come on that front, I can tell you, I'm sure. You deal with it honestly. You deal with it directly. You're forthright. The way you lose control of these issues in campaigns is by misleading, by lying, by equivocating, and not by being direct. The voters, I think, will give you a second chance. And I think they'll give him a second chance. And listen, I remember way back when I used to work for Tom Allen in Maine, who was a congressman from the Portland district. Great guy, really my first client in the political consulting business when I was starting doing, you know, this advertising stuff. 1994, we lost the primary for governor, but he won a House race 2 years later and got elected, you know, four times after that. You know, and I remember telling him, you know, as we went into the election in 2005, I said, listen, I don't see how you beat her. She's 25 points ahead. She's got twice as much money as you. What is the rationale for winning this thing? And his view was, well, if I lose, I lose. You know, I'm going to move on from my career. I'm sort of, I did this and now I, you know, I want to do that. And if I can't do it, I'll do something else, you know? And, you know, and I think now after all these years of Collins, you know, really he's got to make this campaign about himself in terms of reassurance and about her in terms of the consequences of electing someone who will do as she has done, which is to support Donald Trump on the really big issues, okay? Whether it's his tax policy or his Supreme Court. She's always been toe-to-toe with him, okay, when it came to the big things, and she will be for 6 years if she's reelected. I think if you keep it simple like that, be honest about what they're saying about you, trust the people, and be very clear about what will happen if she's elected again. I think that message will win.
We see so many of the reflexes of the Democratic Party and the establishment now taking shots at Zohran Mamdani, certainly before he was elected. You saw this huge attempt to preempt him. We see those things happening against other progressive-minded candidates. And yet progressives, grassroots populist Democrats are having a moment. You know, we just saw that Zohran Mamdani's candidates all won their races in New York, and they were advocating issues that the Democratic Party has considered a third rail, distancing itself from Israel, criticizing, the corruption of the election process. What should the Democratic Party be taking from the rise of this young new generation of populist Democrats?
Well, instead of putting a stop sign out to them, they should put a doormat that says welcome. Okay, that's the problem with it. I remember being in New York. I mentioned I was in New York, when this whole book thing started. I think I mentioned it to you, or maybe it was my earlier interview. But they tried to stop Mamdani, you know, by pouring in tens of millions of dollars of, you know, and just blasting him on everything, and he was able to prevail. I think for two reasons. Just I wasn't involved in that campaign. I saw it from a distance.
Prevail, and it was a blowout. Now, he blew out Andrew Cuomo, a dynastic candidate.
And there's an important reason that I think is overlooked by the press on why he succeeded and how he succeeded. I think the obvious reason, which is something I remember, one of my former business partners, Julian Mulvey, was at the firm that did the advertising for Mamdani's campaign. So when he sent me the first ad, just, you know, because I'm sort of, I've always been, you know, someone, I was his teacher in college before we became business partners, you know, so we've always kept in touch. You know, when he sent it to me, I texted him back and said, I just saw the ad. I think he's going to win. He said, well, you're the only guy in America who say, why do you say that? I said, because he smiles, you know, and he's making that sort of, I mean, this is a guy who really connects with people on a human level, you know, but what is overlooked by the press in terms of his success, how did he succeed against this flood of special interest money? I'll tell you what he had. New York has a system of campaign finance. And it's a matching system. I think it's 5-1. You raise a dollar, you get five, you know, and as a result of that system of campaign finance, Mamdani was able to create a floor of communication, much of it in social media, but a lot of it on television as well, okay, where he could actually communicate a message, even though there was a torrent of negative message coming against him. It was enough, I think, to provide reassurance to voters against all of these attacks. And one way to start to win this war that I referred to before, that we must win if we want to take back this government, is to try to put in place the kind of campaign finance mechanism that they have in New York City that allows people to come in and to raise money to ward off the super PAC. Because you don't have to spend as much as they do to win. You have to spend as much as you need to get the voters to understand your message or the reassurance that you want to offer against their attacks, okay? And that's what happened in the mayor's race in New York. He had enough of a floor that even though they had all the bombs they were dropping from high above, it wasn't enough to take him out of the race. So I think that's what we need. We need some steps like that to give people a chance. And if we do, and if we welcome these people in. Now, having said that, I also want to be very clear. that when people want, you know, if you're a Democrat, I'm not a Democratic Socialist myself. I'm a Democrat. So, but if the Democratic Socialists are winning like they did in New York and could succeed in other places as well, I say that's great. And let's become part of our party. But you can't come in and say that if you want our votes, this is the litmus test that you must agree to. You know, whether it's foreign policy or domestic policy or issues like that, if you don't agree with the 100%, you're out. I don't think Mamdani is pursuing that point. Here's a guy who, you know, Jamie Dimon would come out and call him a communist after he wins. And apparently he's like meeting with Jamie Dimon now, you know, and in small meetings with people and talking to him. I think that's smart. You know, he did something that Bernie would never do, which is when he got nominated and they said, are you a Democrat? He said, yeah, I'm running the Democratic nominee for mayor of New York City. I'm a Democrat. You know, I could never hear those words coming out of Bernie's mouth, I think, ever. But, you know, and I think that's smart play. I think that they should want to be part of our party, Democratic Socialists, and we should welcome them to be part of our party. And when they come in, everybody's got to understand that there will be things that we disagree on, okay? And we can live with it as long as you're going to show up and, you know, make Joaquin Jeffries the leader of the House and whoever. I don't know who's going to be the leader of the Senate. So I like Chuck Schumer personally, but I don't think he's going to make it, to be honest with you, because I think if they take over the Senate, they're just going to have to understand if they don't change the face of it, they're going to be in the same trouble they're in today. And I think many of them will understand that.
So, Tad, you have the long view in politics. You've been at this a long time. The point and the purpose of your book is presumably the purpose of all Democratic politics right now, which is how do you beat Trump and MAGA, you know, or whoever the Trump designee is, the anointed candidate in 2028? Just close with your thoughts about what is Trump? I mean, Trump is clearly a very gifted politician. What does he do well, and what will it take to beat him by the Democrats?
Well, I think what he does well is dominate the media, you know, and he accepts every media opportunity, even his court appearances, to exploit, you know, mass messaging. Okay, that's what he does better than anybody else. This guy, you know, will show up, you know, at anything and drive the media towards him. Now, of course, he has the biggest megaphone in the world, so it's a lot easier attracting the media. So I think to beat Trump, you have to confront him, okay? I mean, for example, in 2020, I didn't work on the Biden campaign sort of the centerpiece, you know, advertising thing. But I did the advertising along with my partner, Julia Mulvey, for the Democratic National Committee. And we devised an advertising campaign that didn't cost a lot of money. I think in total, we spent like $2 million on it. You know, it sounds like a lot, but it's not when you're campaign spending $1 billion, you know, on, you know, messaging a campaign. And all of those ads, I think we produced 16 or 17, most of them were 60-second ads, were really tough Trump ads. It started with they asked us to do one about the 50th anniversary of his announcement, and it began on the escalator and said, you know, 5 years ago, Donald Trump descended into the basement of Trump Towers, and for the last 5 years, he brought America along with him. And then we offloaded on him, on everything. And in the course of the campaign, when all of these things that he did, when he said that American troops who sacrificed their lives for the defense of this nation were suckers and losers, you know, in a graveyard in France. And, you know, we went out and we made ads and we, you know, targeted those ads to an audience of one, Donald Trump, you know, and he would, you know, I remember he was flying into Nevada. We did that ad about what he said about the soldiers. And we heard later that he saw it on Air Force One and absolutely melted down. It was, you know, when the first ad that we did, after we made the ad, Mary Beth Cahill was running the DNC, called me. I think it went on Tuesday. She called me on Thursday. She says, oh, this is such a great success. We've had 700,000 views in 2 days, you know, an ad that we paid just, you know, a few dollars to put it on TV, and hundreds of thousands of people are seeing it. Friday, Trump tweeted about the ad. By Monday, we were up to 5 million views. Okay. And we constantly replicated that process where we got into his head and we made him talk about these ads against him, and we got huge audiences both online and elsewhere. The press would pick up on it and run it on television shows. Then more people would run it. You know, that's what you've got to do, this guy. You got to put him in a corner. You got to keep him in that corner, and you got to keep hitting him, okay? And you don't have to do it in a cheap or ugly way. You can do it with the words coming out of his mouth. Okay, that's all you have to put in front of people. It has to be systematic and it's got to be directed towards him. And I think when you do that, you know, and that's why, like, for example, you know, if Bernie had been the nominee in 2016 instead of Trump, we would have contested Wisconsin. You know, Hillary never went there, as far as I can tell. You know, we would have contested Michigan. And we would have drawn lines on issues with Trump that, you know, Hillary could never draw, like NAFTA, for example, in Michigan. You know, one of the reasons he won that primary is that, you know, we targeted it early. We knew we needed a big place to win to keep going in the race. And we went to them with a trade message, you know, and you know, obviously she couldn't do things like that. You know, Trump did. You know, I think, and I write about this in the book, Trump listened to a lot of the stuff Bernie was saying at the beginning of the campaign, adopted it, and then he threw on top of it what the Republicans only used to say behind closed doors, which is racism and xenophobia and outright, you know, racist attacks against people and attacks against Muslims and everything else. You know, they would do that in a more quiet way with their television advertising. He did it with a megaphone. But he also talked about, we can't cut Social Security, we can't cut Medicare, we can't cut Medicaid, we can't, you know, people are getting screwed. There's, you know, the lobbyists are killing us, you know, all the stuff that Bernie was saying. And then he started saying rigged economy, rigged economy, rigged economy. And I know he didn't invent that because Bernie was saying it months before, you know. So that's what I think you got to do. You've got to confront him. You've got to corner him. But you also have to explain to people that in the things they care about, you are with them. OK. And if you do that, if the Democrats do that, I think we can win a lot of voters. And when they come after us in 2024 is a great example of this. When they come after us with, you know, they had an ad in 2024 about trans prisoners who were getting surgery. They put, to change, you know, their sexual orientation. These, you know, ads, they spent $125 million on that one ad, different versions of that one ad. Okay. Now, in 2004, when I worked for John Kerry, our entire budget in the federal grant was $76 million. Okay, they spent $125 million on one ad, and that ad was never responded to by Kamala Harris's campaign because I think within them, their ranks, they couldn't figure out how they wanted to handle this. You know, I would contrast that to the first ad we did for Bernie Sanders in 2016, which was a long 5-minute ad called Progress that, you know, talked about his growing up, talked about his career, and talked about his vision for America. And when we were talking about the civil rights part of his career, when he was a young man, you know, working on the civil rights movement, you know, and a lot of this was just conversation, me sitting there asking him questions and him comes to, and he said, you know, and he talked about discrimination, you know, whether people are, you know, black or Hispanic, whether they're gay or transgender, they are human beings. Now, I don't think anyone up to that point in time had ever put out an online ad, but it was viewed by 5 million people, you know, an ad that suggested that you were going to be an advocate for transgender rights until Bernie Sanders did it in 2015, okay, when that ad went out. And we never had a problem with it. Now, of course, we were in the Democratic primary, but when, you know, if he had won and they had taken, oh, he said transgender in one of his ads, let's put it in front of the people and scare them in, you know, wherever, Wisconsin, Michigan or anything. I'm telling you, we would not have run away from that. We would have run towards it. Okay. And we would have explained to people that he believes that they are human beings. And this is how we treat people. We don't discriminate against them on the basis of who they are. Okay. And I think that argument would have won the day. I really do.
Well, Tad Devine, thank you for joining us on the Vermont Conversation.
Great. Thank you, David. Good to be with you.
Tad Devine is a veteran Democratic operative and was the former chief campaign strategist for Bernie Sanders' 2016 presidential run. He has a new book, How the Democrats Screwed Bernie. That does it for this week's Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. Thanks so much for listening.